Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Zachary R. Wood. He's here to talk about his new book, Uncensored, My Life and Uncomfortable Conversations at the Intersection of Black and White America. Zachary is a 2018 graduate of Williams College, and I've never heard of Williams College other than the controversy, and so it's right up in the northwest corner of the Commonwealth where New York and Vermont meet. But while you were in college, Zachary, you were the president of this Uncomfortable Learning. It's a student group, and you invited these provocative speakers to campus with all different viewpoints. So I know that's not a huge part of the book, but it is the backdrop of it. So can you kind of tell me the speakers you booked on campus? They were people that you personally disagreed with, being a liberal Democrat. Why bring them to campus?
So basically, the reason behind bringing them to campus was to spark debate, to give students an opportunity to develop their argumentative skills, and to prepare them to be able to go out into the world and more effectively articulate differences of opinion, to advocate for what they believe in, and then understand intellectually the obstacles that stand in the way of the change they seek to achieve.
When you have these speakers come in, did your viewpoint ever change on anything based upon something a speaker told you?
You know, no, I gained a deeper understanding. You know, many of the speakers I brought in tended to have views that were more extreme. There are exceptions, but, you know, my position hardly modified. However, I did gain a deeper understanding of the principles that explain and the values that explain some of the perspectives that they have.
At a liberal arts college, you would think that the idea of the faculty, the administration, and even the students would be bring in speakers of all different ilk and
right,
let the chips
right.
fall where they may. That wasn't the case, right?
Definitely. So you would hope and expect that would be the case, but in my case, at Williams, it was the administration valued social tolerance more than political tolerance, and that was an issue.
So it's kind of ironic that they would have that idea. When you would have this debate with people or argument with people, what was their understanding as to your reasons, and what were the reasons they would give you that we don't want to have Charles Murray, the author of The Bell Curve, here to speak, things like that?
So their perception of what I was doing was that, you know, I wanted to spark debate, but that what I was doing was very harmful to the Williams community, that it had a detrimental impact on students, on their emotional, psychological well-being on campus, that it made people feel less welcome, as though they were not included in the community, and that actually the speakers I was bringing dehumanized them and denied their right to exist on campus. So they were very strong claims. There were many grievances that made it very difficult for a number of students, many of whom were minorities, to engage with Uncomfortable Learning. And so in response to that, I tried to meet with people one-on-one and, you know, really give them a chance to explain the issues they had with it and to see how I could make it so that it would be something more people could take part in.
Well, you're a very intellectual, very intelligent fellow, and you didn't need this student group, I don't think, to achieve any of your academic goals. So
right.
Was there ever a point that you got to where you said, to hell with it, this isn't even worth my time arguing with you people, do what you want?
You know, there were times where it was difficult. There were times where it was very trying. However, I one day would like to pursue a career in public service, and I think that that requires a commitment to the beliefs and values that I hold, and I'm committed to open dialogue. I think it's absolutely critical for our society more broadly and for higher education in particular. So once it was something that I saw as a part of my work and as a part of my niche on campus, I was pretty committed to it. And so despite the challenges and the adversity I faced, I was pretty resolved in terms of kind of pushing forward and trying to achieve whatever change I could.
You grew up in, well, Michigan and later Washington, D.C., but the great part of the book is about your upbringing, and you didn't have a lot of money. Your mother had mental health issues. Can you kind of take us back to those schools that you went to in Michigan where the buzzword that was used to describe you by some teachers was disruptive? What did that mean to you?
So disruptive, you know, you have teachers, when I was in Detroit Public Schools, who are, you know, they care deeply about what they're doing, they care about their students, they want to make a difference, and they want to be effective educators. However, they're in under-resourced communities. They're in schools that have a lack of funding, a lack of resources, issues with allocation, and then they have students who sometimes are coming to school not having eaten and who face a number of challenges outside the bounds of the school itself. And so essentially what happens is you have many students who need special attention, and so it's very difficult for them to engage with that. And so for someone like me who wanted to ask a lot of questions and be challenged and push for a deeper understanding, that was seen as disruptive because in that kind of environment, they wanted students to be quiet, obedient, and simply do their work.
I live in a community where it's not hugely diverse. There's some diversity. You get outside of the city here, and it's not diverse at all. So can you kind of take us back to where you were as far as the racial taunts that you got growing up in school?
Yes. So when I started going to a private school, I was living in Detroit at the time, in an area that was a disadvantaged community. And when I started going to this school, it was in a very affluent suburb just outside of Detroit called Grosse Pointe Farms. And so I was familiar with it. You know, I had driven through it, but I had never, you know, I did not know what it would be like until I got there to go to school with kids who had lived lives that were so different from my own. And so in terms of race, you know, when I got there, there were so many subtle assumptions, so many interactions that I had with people where it was clear that based upon our differences in terms of our backgrounds, there were various things that were racially understood in ways that were sometimes concerning, in ways that sometimes made me really want to try to seek a better understanding of why they saw things that way. And ultimately, it really challenged me to step outside of myself and try to make an effort to listen and see where people were coming from without making judgment.
Was this based upon ignorance or culture, both, none?
You know, I think, you know, these are, at this point you're talking about fourth graders.
So right.
I don't want to say ignorance, and I don't want to say that, it, you know, because you're only so responsible when you're that young. I think, though, really it's a product of the conversations they were having at the dinner table, the exposure that they'd had to African Americans, to minorities at that point, and to some of the things that they perhaps heard in their communities, experiences that they had, things their parents would say to them. And so it's a combination of all of those sociocultural factors, I think, that inform the various understandings they had, whether it was kind of the prejudgment that, you know, I only loved rap music and no other kind of music, or the assumption that, you know, I was a great basketball player.
Another part of the book that I found fascinating was when you moved back to Washington, D.C., and you started on this two-hour commute to a prep school.
Right.
2 hours to a school just seems an insane amount of commuting time for a kid. What's that like just preparing you for the day? I mean, you're putting in more hours just getting to school than a lot of kids are with homework.
You know, it is one of the greatest challenges I've ever faced, having to wake up at 4:45, 4:50 every single day. You know, I'm not getting home because of the commute and because of my involvement with various co-curricular and extracurricular activities like student government and so forth until 8, 9 o'clock. Then I'm taking APs and honors courses, so I'm up until 1, 2 sometimes. And so I'm getting 2.5, 3 hours, at best 4 hours of sleep. It was grueling. It was exhausting. But I was really just determined to make the most of my education because my grandmother and my mom taught me that that was something I had control over, unlike financial circumstances. Knowledge and my pursuit of it was something that I could take control of and use to make a difference in the world.
Well, in your time in D.C., you're in one of the poorest areas of the city, right?
Right, yes.
So what makes it a poor area? I mean, what didn't you have that a lot of the other kids that went to this prep school had?
Well, one simple, very basic thing was I had a faulty roof. And so that meant that every time it rained, it was like it was raining inside the house because there was a gaping hole in the ceiling. And no matter how many times we tried to kind of fix this in various makeshift ways, because the roof was so bad, every time it rained, it was like kind of a waterfall coming through the roof. And so if you're trying to sleep, your bed's wet, the floor is wet. You know, on top of that, you're talking about a community that just has a general lack of resources, a general lack of access to opportunity. But in concrete terms, it was that the living conditions under which I had to do my homework and sleep and so forth were drastically different from my peers, from having a hole in the ceiling to a hole in the kitchen floor to having five people living in a house with two bedrooms. It was just extremely difficult.
now you are after graduation. You graduated this year from Williams, and it's got you listed as a Robert L. Bartley Fellow at the Wall Street Journal and apparently an assistant editor at the Atlantic. What are your roles?
So I at the Atlantic, I'm going to be starting there soon as assistant editor, and I'm going to be hopefully writing about issues of education and inequality, social mobility, and economic opportunity, and working on editing various sections of the magazine and online, and working with a great team that I'm really excited to join.
And I know you've done the math. When year can you run for president?
So I'm thinking 2044.
All right. Well, stay tuned for that. The book is Uncensored, My Life and Uncomfortable Conversations at the Intersection of Black and White America by Zachary R. Wood. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Dutton. It's just a tremendous story, and people may balk at reading a memoir written by somebody who's in his early 20s, but I tell you what, this guy's lived more of a life than a lot of people I know for an entire lifetime. Zachary, fantastic offering here. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks so much, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.